Now beginning in the middle of page 11, the dragon. The adversary, as the dragon, has slowly but surely been extending his power. First in Egypt, next in Assyria, then in Babylon, next in Medo-Persia. In the fifth world power, he became known as Zeus. Daniel said this power was to bear rule over all the earth. And you go back on Discourse 7 and you'll see that. In the days of Jesus, his authority was established in Rome. The adversary offered this authority to Jesus. Luke 4:6, back on page 5, you saw that. He later made this offer to Muhammad through one of his angels. I told you that. The Library of Universal History by Clare says, "Thus Muhammad yielded to the temptation which Christ resisted." That's a history book approved by 5 big universities. Further, no imposter, civil or religious, could ever succeed in establishing a permanent influence over the minds of millions of the human race. The Muslims now number more than 1 billion. Now, just to jump ahead a minute, you're seeing right currently, as we're making these tapes, the so-called peace conference of Madrid. And you can't have peace conference when the Arabs want the whole of Israel. They don't want Israel there at all. Now, Israel already gave up the Sinai, got nothing. Now they want Israel to give up part of the occupied lands, and then tomorrow they'll ask for the rest of them and try to push Israel out altogether. They hate the Jews. And so you're not going to get peace because God's bringing these things to pass. Now, let's go further. There are many Bible references to God's angels appearing on the earth. What happened to the adversary's angels that were cast out of heaven with him? God's angels and the adversary's angels were at one time of the same heavenly creation. If God's angels appear to men, why should the adversary's angels not likewise be appearing to men? They do appear, but the adversary presents his angelic forces in a very hidden and confused manner. The dragon uses his angels to operate under his authority for the control of world powers. His angels are referred to as geniuses or demons. Refer to Discourse 5. Now, we're going a little bit here so that you'll have some idea of what's going on. Top of page 12. Hesiod speaks of demons and says that there were 30,000 in number, and that they dwelled on earth unseen by mortals as the ministers of Zeus. So they knew his name. They were a lot smarter than we are, I guess, in many things. Now, the Midrash Rabbah, which is a Jewish, research type of book, standby book, refers to male and female demons in Numbers, page 420. Now, that's very interesting because that's the only reference I know of to female demons. Destroying demons in Numbers, page 815, and thousands of demons, that is the quantity idea, in Deuteronomy, page 92. So this is known and mentioned in the Jewish writings. Now, I boxed the next little paragraph for myself. The Roman Empire began in B.C. 31. You need to remember these dates, or at least know where you can find them. I don't mean learn them, but know that where they are. Here they are. Octavius Caesar, sole master of the Roman world, titled Augustus the Divine. Now this man here, the statue, that is Octavius Caesar. But when he was given the title Augustus the Divine, see, he became a god. Why? Because he had one of the angels. That little character down there by his leg, that's his genius, B.T. 27. He's called Pontifex Maximus, chief bridge builder. See, Pontifex Maximus, B.C. 12. We're getting closer to the time of Jesus. Supreme in all religious affairs. Now, look at the Dictionary of Greek and Roman Biography and Mythology. Genius, a protecting spirit analogous to the guardian angels invoked by the Church of Rome. The belief in such spirits existed both in Greece and Rome. The Greeks called them demons and appear to have believed in them from the earliest times, though Homer does not mention them. Hesiod speaks, I have it from above, from here, demons, and says that there were 30,000 in number, that they dwelled on earth unseen by mortals as the ministers of Zeus. The demons are further described as the ministers and companions of the gods. I wanted to give you a little more support. Here they keep showing up. Look underneath of the first coin to your left. The solidus above, it's reverse showing victory riding V-O-T-X-X on a shield held by a genius, was struck to commemorate Constantine's 20th year in power. A genius was thought to be a spirit who watched over each man and was largely responsible for his lot in life. A similar figure was used centuries later on the coin of France to represent the genius of the nation writing a new constitution at the time of the French Revolution. So that's the coin to your right. Now, Napoleon III's disastrous defeat in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 led to the Third Republic, which lasted until World War II. For its coin designs, the New Republic at first turned to a design used during the First Republic, an angel, or genius, writing the word Constitution on a tablet. So he's an angel, or genius, they're the same. It's just another name, and they go by the name demon. So it gets very complicated. All right, now, look at the top of page 13. Satan's, Zeus's angels. Now, I just put four of them there to show you representative. Are they all alike? I don't know that. Of course, I had to use some kind of an indication to keep you in mind, and I used a picture of the one we've got from Doré in the Garden of Eden, and that's as good as any. And so I put four of them there to show you that now we're talking about a military unit. He has all these angels so that he can have a commander over one unit that's working on world control and another commander that's working with the perversion of Scripture. And he's got sub-people under that, perhaps as high as they've given, or even higher for all we know, 30,000. I don't know who counted them. I know that where they found out, whether some ancient record exists or not. I don't know. In idolatry, these angels were called agathodaimons, good demons. Now, you've got to remember there are good demons and evil demons. Those evil demons that Jesus cast out, there's no record in the New Testament of casting out what are called demons after the death of the Lord Jesus Christ. They cast out some evil spirits, and then demon takes this new idea. We're going to see it shortly. Caesar Augustus had his genius. Zeus ruled the Roman Empire, where Caesar Augustus was supreme in all religious affairs, having the title Pontifex Maximus, chief bridge builder. Page 12. Jesus was born during his reign. When Jesus secured victory at the cross, Zeus attacked the Christians through 10 periods of trial. Here they are. Revelation 2. You be not fearing things which you are about to be suffering. God's giving warning to the church. Behold, the slander is about to be casting some out of you into a guardhouse, in order that you might be tried, and you will have tribulation of 10 days. You notice? Very careful. The slander is about to be casting you. He had a lot of authority, didn't he? This idea that he has no authority, forget it. This is after the cross. You'll be becoming trustworthy unto death, and I will give to you the crown of the life. The one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the assemblies, plural. The one having victory, by no means might he be done harm out of the death, namely the second. So here we have a clearer case stated in Scripture to a church after the crucifixion, and the sending of the Holy Spirit tells us that the slanderer was about to be casting some of them into the guardhouse in order that they'd be tried. So the slanderer had a tremendous amount of power. And of course, you've seen already, he put his workers in on the translation. These tribulations were further signified by the 10 horns of Daniel 7:7. And we put the head of the beast there. Now that's back on Apologetics 22. When Zeus failed to stop the preaching of the gospel, he decided to join the church and run the operation. To this end, he chose Constantine as the means to enter the church, giving him the title Pontifex Maximus. Now go to the Britannica article. Christianity as the state religion. The Edict of Milan, a cluster of documents issued by Constantine the Great in 313, made Christianity a lawful religion. By the end of the 4th century, it had become the state religion. Historians call the church of this period the Constantinian Church, designating the privileged position of the church within the state. The early Middle Ages, especially from 4th to 7th century, were the ages of great ecumenical or general councils. Get that word, ecumenical? You know, we've had it already. It was no doubt the new Roman character, the Constantinian Church. Notice the Roman character, that's important, that led Christians to look for an expression of the voice of the whole church, the Catholicae, that would be the voice of the whole world, the oikumene. See, whole world, it isn't whole world, the inhabited earth. Just as the emperor was the voice of secular authority for the whole world. Well, he wasn't. For the inhabited earth, he was. Even the encyclopedia makes this kind of a mistake. All right, now, coming to the top of page 14. Would you build temples to a non-existent god? I'm trying to ask you some sensible questions. Would you build a temple? Look at these lovely temples. Jupiter at Olympia, Diana at Ephesus, Jupiter at Athens, Castor and Pollux at Rome. These things cost thousands, in our money, thousands and thousands of dollars. Rome, back up to the paragraph, Rome itself had 420 such temples in 325 A.D. Constantine called the Council of Nicaea. As Pontifex Maximus, that is, the complete head of religious affairs, he was leader of the pagan idolatry. He is said to have had a vision of Apollo at a shrine in Gaul. See Apologetics 23, page 2. Now, come under these temples, and let's go another step. Roman Emperor Theodosius I declared Christianity the state religion, and that was done on February the 27th, 380 A.D., Now, Theodosius issued an edict positively forbidding any and all pagan ceremonies on penalty of death, and closed all the heathen temples and confiscated their endowments. Theodosius the Great was the last emperor who reigned over the whole Roman dominions. He died in A.D. 395. Pope Leo I took the title Pontifex Maximus. All right, now look at these statues. The one to the left there is Diana of the Ephesians. And there to the center is Pallas Athene of the Greeks. And there is Zeus or Jupiter to the right. Now let me ask you a question. I know you're going to think it's silly, but that's what you're going to have to face. Would you make statues of Little Red Riding Hood or Snow White and then talk to them or even pray to them? Well, then if you accuse these of not having anything real about them, that's what you're accusing these people of doing, making statues to Little Red Riding Hood, as it were. In other words, these are entities. They are, as you had back there, and I'm going to keep on taking you back there to that big headline that I put back on page 8, that all the gods of the Gentiles are demons. They're not Red Riding Hood. They're demons. All right, now, come up to the top of page 15. The Roman Empire had now entered the church, that is, the Roman church. The Latin language is still used. Great cathedrals were built. Images were made to which prayers are offered. Zeus had moved his authority into the seventh world power which he had developed. The word Catholic was added to Roman. The Catholic Church was to be universal, oikumene, that is, ecumenical. It was to speak for the whole world. Zeus's authority is limited to the seventh world power. Oikumene does not mean world, but the inhabited earth. While there are no physical boundaries, There is a limit fixed by its name, the Roman Ecumenical Assembly, the true name of the Catholic Church, the Roman Ecumenical Assembly. That's the seventh world power. And we show you the temple to a goddess. This is Notre Dame, Our Lady. Okay, made to honor Mary. And here you see underneath the picture, the Pope prays to whom the statue represents. So did the Romans. He didn't pray to that statue as such. He prayed to what the statue represents, the demon back of it. And remember, we had from the Jewish writings, there are female demons. So he prays to the demon back of it. Now, here's Haley's Bible Handbook, which if you don't own one, I suggest you get one. They're in paperback. They're quite cheap, even in the bookstores. So you can get it. And I suggest you own one so that you could read it and get a lot of good information. Now, I don't mean to tell you that it's infallible. It isn't. It's got a lot of things with which I would disagree. But it does have a lot of worthwhile history and worthwhile information on the papacy. And I took this particular article here for us so that we can look at it. Emperor Constantine, when he became a Christian, now that's assuming he became a Christian. I don't think Constantine was a Christian ever. Now, you can check that up on an earlier course. We've had that on various apologetics, because after he was supposedly a Christian, he wasn't baptized till he was on his deathbed, and not only that, but he murdered his wife and son and so forth executed. I mean, no semblance of a Christian. Issued an edict granting everybody the right to choose his own religion. Emperor Theodosius made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire, I've told you that, made church membership compulsory. This was the worst calamity that has ever befallen the church. This forced conversion filled the churches with unregenerate people. In other words, he said they couldn't worship the idols anymore, but they had to be a member of church. So the only thing they could do was join the ecumenical church. And that's exactly the kind of a pattern you see it even today as the Eastern religions and all join it. Now, next paragraph. Not only so, Theodosius undertook the forcible suppression of all other religions and prohibited idol worship. Under the decrees, heathen temples were torn down by mobs of Christians, get that, and there was much bloodshed. So you see, the Christians weren't any better than the heathens. Christ had designed to conquer by purely spiritual and moral means. Up to this time, conversion was voluntary, a genuine change in heart and life. Now, the next paragraph, I'd color this next paragraph. It's a well-versed paragraph. I put a big arrow there to call it to your attention. Watch carefully. But now, the military spirit of Imperial Rome, that's the great Roman Empire, the sixth world power, had entered the church. The church had conquered the Roman Empire. But in reality, the Roman Empire had conquered the church by making the church over into the image of the Roman Empire. And we had then the seventh world power. The church had changed its nature, had entered its great apostasy, I don't follow that, and become a political organization in the spirit and pattern of Imperial Rome. Now we'll come to apostasy later. It has nothing to do with the church. And took its nosedive into the millennium of papal abominations. That's true. The imperial church of the 4th and 5th centuries had become an entirely different institution from the persecuted church of the first three centuries. In its ambition to rule, it lost and forgot the spirit of Christ. Worship, at first very simple, was developed into elaborate, stately, imposing ceremonies, having all the outward splendor that had belonged to heathen temples. Ministers became priests. The term priest was not applied to Christian ministers before AD 200. It was borrowed from the Jewish system and from the example of heathen priesthood. Leo I prohibited priests from marrying, and celibacy of priests became a law of the Roman Church. Conversion of the barbarians. Now here's another paragraph worth your marking particularly. The Goths, the Vandals, the Huns, some of you know who they are, overthrew the Roman Empire, accepted Christianity, but to a large extent their conversion was nominal, and this further filled the church with pagan practices. In other words, all these various overrunning tribes that didn't intermarry just moved into the church as nominal Christians. Now, the church was so full of nominal Christians, I don't think there were hardly any real Christians in it. And the few real Christians, they began to persecute. And we'll see that some other time. We've covered a lot of that. We're not covering that right now. We're working on to show you the Jewish situation. Conflicts with heathen philosophies, even as every generation seeks to interpret Christ in terms of its own thinking. See that? So no sooner had Christianity made its appearance than it began its process of amalgamation with Greek and Oriental philosophies. See, they were all pulling everything in together. And there arose many sects, Gnosticism, and all of these whole lists. There's no use of reading them. From the 2nd to the 6th centuries, the church was rent with controversies over these and similar isms, and almost lost sight of its true mission. It did, really. All right, now we go over to the top of page 16. The seventh world power was established. The Council of Ephesus, 431 A.D., decided that Mary was the Mother of God. Pope Leo, 440 to 461, took the title of Pontifex Maximus, Chief Bridge Builder. Under Pope Felix IV, pagan temples were converted for Christian worship. Apologetics 33. Under Pope Boniface IV, the great Roman pantheon, once dedicated to all the gods, was now dedicated to the Blessed Virgin Mary and the martyrs. Now there's a picture of that, the Roman pantheon, right there in front of you on this page. Zeus felt secure enough to start the eighth world power. An angel called Gabriel appeared to Muhammad. See page 11. The Hegira, 622 A.D., is the point from which Mohammedans reckon time. And you have to go back to Discourse 5 again, because these things are picking up from there. Now here's a good picture above a painting of Mohammed being given a message by the angel Gabriel. Mohammed was often shown as faceless, but with a burning halo. That looks like a big upside-down ice cream cone on his head. That's the burning halo. And the angel is giving him the message. And he was a goase. In other words, that he said, God told me, like people are doing today. God's not telling him anything. But he said, God told me. That's where he got it. Now there to your right is see the chair of St. Peter in the Vatican. And that's engraved with the exploits of Hercules, son of Zeus. That's what's carved on that chair. It goes way on back in history, probably 300 or 400 A.D. Now, the major controller of world power is the dragon aspect. Leaving the discussion of world political power, let us return to Revelation chapter 12. We need now to consider the first sign. That's what we're going back on for now. All right. The explanation of the woman will depend on the understanding in regards as to whom the child is. The adversary's ministers in the church have planted a great deal of anti-Semitism in the Bible commentaries and various other writings. Following is one striking example. Here's the Holy Bible, Confraternity Edition, which is Roman Catholic. And it says, here's the woman here, by the way, with the sun and the stars and the moon under her feet. Notice the serpent is under her, too. And that's from a book called Mary, Our Sweet Mother, Society of St. Paul. Now, on chapter 12 in the Holy Bible, Catholic Bible, verse 1, they have this footnote. Now, this is the 1950 version. A woman. This woman is not the Blessed Virgin. That's true. For the details of the prophecy do not fit her. The prophecy pictures the church of the Old and New Testaments. That's false, as you'll see. The beams of the divine glory clothe her. The moon is beneath her feet. She is crowned with a crown of 12 stars, and she must bring forth Christ to the world. Now watch. By accommodation, the church applies this verse to the Blessed Virgin. And so it isn't the Blessed Virgin, but they're going to do it anyway. Well, that's the kind of a lying system it is all the way along. Now, Revelation 12. And a great sign was seen in the heaven, a woman having been and still cast around with the sun, the moon underneath her feet, and on her head a crown of stars 12. And having in her womb and suffering birth pains, she is crying and being tormented to bring forth. And another sign was seen in the heaven. We're going to go slower on all these verses later. And behold, a great dragon, red as fire, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems. And his tail is dragging the third of the stars of the heaven, and he cast them into the earth. Now look out. The dragon has stood and still stands. Remember, John is writing this. In John's time, he sees the dragon has stood in time past and still stands in sight of the woman being Israel, namely the future one to bring forth. It's Israel to bring forth in the future, in order that at the time that she might bring forth, he might devour her child. Now, devour, as I told you a little bit, is not to eat her child at all. You'll see about that in a little while. I called that birth B. Now, 5, she brought forth a son, a male, who is about to be shepherding all the Gentiles with an iron rod, and a child was seized to the God and to his throne. That's the A birth. Now, that's the birth of Jesus. Notice it's past tense when John wrote, she brought forth a son, a male, who is about to be shepherding all the Gentiles, that's future, with an iron rod. So you make believe you're John. There are 2 births, A and B. A is in the time before John, B sometime in the future. Now, birth A is well established by John himself in Revelation 19:15. Once Revelation 12:5 is understood as the birth of Jesus, the woman, Revelation 12:1, will be easily identified as the nation of Israel. There wasn't any such thing as we call the church today. Revelation 19, and I saw the heaven having been and still open, behold a white horse, and the one sitting on it being called trustworthy and authentic, and in justice he is judging and he is warring. But his eyes as a flame of fire, and on his head many diadems, having a name, having been and still written, which not one is knowing absolutely unless himself. And having been and still cast around with a garment, having been and still dipped in blood, and his name has been and is still called the Word of the God. And the armies, namely the ones in the heaven, were following him on white horses, having been and still clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth a sharp sword is proceeding out, in order that with it he might smite the Gentiles, and he himself will shepherd them with a rod of iron. That's what it said in Revelation 12. And he himself is treading the winepress of the wrath, namely of the anger, and of the wrath of the God, namely the Almighty. So that confirms the birth of verse 5, the birth of Jesus. But we have another birth coming up, which is that B account. And that's what we're going to get into more as we continue in the discourse. Now at the top of page 18, we have a few more minutes. The woman Israel is identified by Genesis 37:9-10. Jesus was brought forth into a Jewish family by a Jewish maid Mary. To make this sign other than Israel is false. We need to go back in history to Abraham. We will return to birth B later. All right. Now, here you have Genesis 15:5-6. And he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward heaven and number the stars, if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. And he believed in Jehovah, and he reckoned it to him for righteousness. Stars are in this dream. Joseph is the 12th. And we better leave it there, and we'll start our third lesson at this point. Thank you.